This isn't the Bridgestone paddock. Where am I? What's going on right now? Welcome inside the Bridgestone Canadian Superbike Championship podcast, everybody. It is Marshall Ferguson sitting across from Colin Fraser. We're at a robotics competition, I believe, is happening at the International Center in Mississauga. There's also a bike show, which is why we're actually doing this and sitting down and having a conversation, because A, it's been too long since we've been able to put a podcast up since Daytona, because we went crazy in Daytona and produced like 6 hours worth of conversations with both of us and, of course, Cam Bickle that was down there hanging out with us. And then we came back and it was kind of, well, I guess we'll wait until the season preview episode we get going. And then because we're both very normal and adjusted people, I texted Colin and said, I'm just going to go wander around and look at motorcycles. Do you want to come? Obviously, the answer was yes. On a beautiful sunny day, 15 degrees in sun here in Ontario, Colin decided that we should come sit inside of a conference room of some sort inside the International Center and talk bikes.
Well, the funny thing is it's not that different from the media center at Daytona, really. And again, no windows. Apparently, that's our thing on a nice day.
Yes.
But the robotics people are kind of interesting. I think it's fun. The motorcycle show was slightly interesting, maybe not quite as much fun.
I have never been to the International Center in Mississauga, and my introduction to this place was thinking that entrance 5, which was the robotics conference, was the motorcycle show. So anybody can imagine me wandering through wearing a Honda hoodie and everyone looking at me and going, you, sir, are very clearly in the wrong place.
So on the flip side, a lot of these people are probably going to be tuning motorcycles years from now, right? Because that's the expertise, right?
The engineering Venn diagram, I think, is relevant. But as I said, it's been a while since we've been able to sit down, talk, hang out. We're going to have season preview podcast coming up for you ahead of Shannonville in round one, which is Victoria Day weekend, which is crazy to think it's almost like a month away at this point. And we'll talk about that. We'll do a round one preview. We're going to bring you all sorts of fun stuff from the track. But we wanted to do this just because I think there's something to be said for having a little bit of separation from the actual chaos of Daytona. Because you and I have been talking about it as we're wandering around at this bike show. The number of things that happened in that race that you cannot pick up in real time, that now we have a better understanding, at least you have a better understanding of, because I'm learning in real time talking with you about these things.
Well, you'd swear that Daytona happens at the Nürburgring, right, where the place is so spread out. I mean, it's not that big, but it's remarkable how many things you miss. Just didn't know that happened. And people say, oh, yeah, it's too bad about this, or this guy got hurt, or, you know, that bike had a problem. And it's like, oh, man, I missed that part of that. So, and, of course, the race is 2 hours long, which is a good start.
What are some of the interesting notes, I guess, you know, post-Daytona? Because we did a Daytona recap, but this is like really, really post-Daytona now that you look back on it and you kind of go, huh, yeah, that was interesting coming out of 24, because we might not have been able to get it into the recap we did that day.
Well, I think a little bit to do with the fact that it's, you know, the Gen 2 FIM rules for what we call middleweights. Those rules do get tweaked a little bit in terms of the performance options for different motorcycles. And we've talked a little bit about the Suzuki GSX-R 750, and it's basically competing almost as a stock motorcycle because of restrictions with a fly-by-wire system that bike doesn't come with. And, of course, the Ducati Twins, which have won the last two Daytona races. But without knowing all the details, where I'm headed with this is that the Daytona event, and we touched on this a bit post-race, it turned into a bit of a fuel mileage management.
Crazy.
And I was talking to Ben Young about this the other day, and he was a little surprised, and they had some concerns. And I didn't, speaking of things we didn't know, I didn't know Trevor Daly came in for an extra fuel stop.
The one thing I did know between us in the conversation, because I went, yeah, I was in the hot pit, and I saw him come in, and I tapped somebody on the shoulder and went, was that planned? And they're like, no.
And of course, one of the much touted work Suzukis, or what, you know, the M4 X-Star bikes, ran out of fuel. Mm-hmm. And I believe Heron with his Ducati said at one point he ran in on his way into the pit lane. So fuel mileage has suddenly come back into play. And, you know, a huge amount of effort and planning goes into this. And, you know, we're measuring, weighing, checking fuel. And we talked a little bit about how the tanks have sloshing things in them that restrict a little tiny bit the amount of fuel you can put in, and how the quick fill works can slightly alter the fuel capacity of the stock tank. But people, given this was the third year with these rules, people were not as far in front of the rules as they expected to be, and it did have some effect and could have had a gigantic effect on the race.
Yeah, it was Richie Escalante, for anybody that watched the race, obviously at the end that ends up, and you could see Josh Heron, and I thought it was great from Jason Pridmore and Greg White on the call of that race, where they said, like, if you're Josh Herron, you're just going to essentially low gear this thing and, like, cruise around and try and get yourself home as smoothly as you possibly can. Because he even said, Josh Herron, after he won it for the second year in a row, that, yeah, I was terrified. Like, I had no idea. I had a sense at various points throughout the race that we might be in trouble. And I, on top of all the other thousand things that the riders are dealing with, like, we were joking about what happened with, you know, Trevor Daly and having to come in for that splash and all the rest. It's like, you said, well, you got to put the pit board out, I think was what you said that Willie had mentioned to you, right? Really, Willie Bass, that we had on the podcast after the race was done in Daytona, where there's a lot of stuff going on. And I can't imagine also being at Daytona, dealing with the banking, dealing with everything with your bike, dealing with the traffic.
And well, also, you think about the Suzukis. Trevor has raced a Suzuki Superbike, but you don't race it to empty in Canadian racing.
Right.
Ben has no experience with Suzukis. And how a bike behaves when it's starting to run out of fuel varies hugely. And also, when you're on the banking with the G-Force, in some cases that helps pick up that last little bit of fuel, and sometimes it chases it to a part of the tank where the pickup isn't. So, and it's very hard to know these things unless you've been using that bike for a while and you've used it at Daytona, which is really narrows the amount of information gathering possible. And some of the guys have raced there in the fall, but Daytona is a track that doesn't get used very much for motorcycle racing.
I mean, it was an incredible experience to see those bikes going around. We were even joking as we're at the motorcycle show where there's baggers all over the place that are, of course, coming up to Canadian Tire Motorsport Park with us this year. And I see those baggers and I can't unsee the wobbling and the weaving and I'm never going to be able to unsee that. It's the first experience I've ever seen with those type of bikes racing, so it'll be crazy to see again at CTMP.
Well, I feel a little bit sometimes that the baggers are a little bit like NASCAR, and partly that's because it's not an easy motorcycle to ride. Like, you're earning your keep and it's hard on the tires, it's long wheelbase, so ground clearance is a challenge, and you know, it's some of the guys there are pretty tough guys who are running that class, and it is not a gentle, detail-y activity to ride one of those gigantic motorcycles. And much is made about how fast they are in terms of top speed, but the way they make their speed is so different from what we're used to with a conventional sport bike.
And I want to give a quick shout-out as well to Alex Coelho. I know some of the different guys that went down, the Canadians with the Bridgestone paddock, that were all in there and helping each other out and all the rest, got banged up. I didn't realize that Brad McRae was as dinged as you've said he is, so hoping that he recovers quickly as well and gets back out on track, and excited to see everybody back in the paddock coming up at Shannonville. But let's switch gears for a second here and talk about some industry news, some of the bigger... Actually, you know, before we do that, what did you enjoy the most about the bike show today? I know you kind of jokingly said, it wasn't the most interesting thing. You saw a ton of bikes that were taking you down a little memory lane, though. What stuck out to you?
Well, for me, you know, you tend to go back to when you first got involved, or in a way, almost just before you got involved. So the things
right.
that were influencing the scene, and of course, my interest in sport bikes kind of predates what most people consider a sport bike. It just was a bike that you could use for sports, different thing. But it was fun showing you the, you know, Kawasaki triples and the Z1s and some of the other motorcycles. For me, particularly the Kawasakis from the early 70s were very influential, and I raced some of those motorcycles. And you know, very much what you could afford back then in terms of machinery, and the concept of the series didn't exist in terms of all the equipment and all the structure and tire warmers and slicks and all that stuff was much later to be invented. But I still get a kick out of seeing those bikes and you know, remembering when the paddock was full of all those air-cooled multi-cylinder wobbly weavy motorcycles that behave much like the you accuse the baggers of.
Well, I mean, even it's so funny wandering around and seeing those, because you just casually go, yeah, that rear actually doesn't line up with the front. I'm like, how? Like, why would anybody want to ride that? How is that a
thing? that's a two-stroke triple Kawasaki 500 that's quite famous. And then we were also looking at some newer two-strokes, RZ 500, Honda NS 400 triple, the RG 500, which was one of my favorite bikes to race. So it was fun to see those bikes and all parked together. So that was like, you know, going to one of those airplane museums where you see the fighter planes that fought one another and kind of get an idea of the contrasts in the designs.
Right.
So yeah, that I didn't mention that, but that arguably in terms of sport bikes, because those bikes I just talked about, those two-stroke Japanese machines from the mid-80s, those were the very first real sport bikes.
It was super fun to see it. I brought up this book. I just looked it up while we're sitting here. I actually bought this a couple of weeks ago, How to Build a Motorcycle, A Nut and Bolt Guide to Customizing Your Bike by Gary Inman. And there were so many weird, wacky, wonderful, some chaotic, some incredibly ugly, some super tastefully done that were different. The custom stuff I find just to be so intriguing what people are able to
use
their
imagination. Well, your style's horrible, but the stuff I make is fascinating and creative and beautiful, and I don't understand why you don't think my stuff's delightful. It's just so strange.
The difference of opinion on how to customize those things was pretty amazing to see. But also, Ducati had a huge presence at this show.
There were some really nice Ducatis, and I probably should have led with that. And it's fun to see that how much racing influence. You know, there were an incredible number of Harley Davidsons, and most of them were not baggers by any means. But there were some very, very pretty Ducatis, and some people had done some really nice detail-y work, like not just, you know, stickers of Woody Woodpecker smoking a cigar and some of the things that you think of when you might consider Canadian tire type. Customization. No, actually, some very, very classy looking stuff. And yeah, we saw several Ducatis that were really nice.
And shout out to our man Omar. I just pulled up his customized one with the Ducati front lift as well, which
the real stand. And also, we saw some nice BMWs, right? And you know, several generations of BMW have been around for well over a decade. So now they're starting to leak down into the custom world. Like, there's a relatively affordable bike now that you can start building something interesting out of. And of course, CSBK has an awful lot of very fast BMWs.
I'm going to say my final one, just to put a bow on this show, and the reason that we're sitting inside of this conference room right now was the, was it the 85 Honda NS400R?
Yeah, that's a triple.
Yeah, that thing was cool. Maybe it's just the Rothmans branding on the side of it that I thought was kind of cool, but no, it's super sweet to see kind of like the old nostalgic Honda logo and the design and all that stuff.
And it came like that, right?
It's pretty. Very, very nice bike. So let's talk about some of the things that have been happening, as I mentioned, with essentially the acquisition of MotoGP by Liberty. I know anybody who is into the top end of MotoGP or maybe just in sports business, this is intriguing, but I mean, I had thoughts on it originally going in. You and I had been, you were the one that actually put this on my radar a couple of weeks ago and said, hey, this is rumored to be happening. Here's a couple of articles about Liberty, who owns Formula One, potentially going ahead and getting MotoGP. And I started immediately going, oh God, what are they going to do? What are they going to do to change it? Like, what's the downside of this? And I think I am just basically conflict averse, where I think, what are they going to do to ruin the thing that I've just started falling in love and enjoying watching, right? And my first terrifying thought was that they were going to do something, or they could do something, like Vegas, like F1. And F1 Vegas made a ton of money. We saw the economic report that came out on that as well. But it was like, are you going to go to a place that's just, you want to create chaos because you're a content company, or are you going somewhere because it's racing and it's really racing? And immediately everything that I have read said, yeah, we're not certifying road course. Like, get over the idea that they're just going to start throwing them in random places in America because Liberty's based out of that.
Well, I find it interesting that given our focus most of the time is producing video, chaos is what we thrive on, right?
Like
as soon as it rains, we know we're going to have a great story. And, you know, I always say, well, the spectator at home sitting on his couch, he's not getting rained on. We're getting rained on, but we can dry off later. And, you know, racing in the rain is frequently very entertaining. I think, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about what could happen with Dorna, which is the parent company of MotoGP and bought World Superbike well over a decade ago and have been running it for just over a decade. So basically the two premier two-wheel road racing series in the world are owned by Dorna. And
Spanish-based, correct.
Yeah, a lot of interesting things have been going on with Dorna, and they've been doing pretty well with growing the sport, maybe not quite where Liberty's been, but in the neighborhood. And they, you know, if you're European-based sports marketing, those companies face each other, right? They're definitely paying attention. The biggest difference would probably be that Drive to Survive, which was the Netflix deal that Liberty did for Formula One, has been incredibly successful, partly due to COVID. That has had an effect on everybody, including CSBK, in a positive way. Dorna, their deal was with Apple, and their series didn't do nearly as well. So that is the biggest difference. And believe it or not, you know, talking about these insider-type stories is central to why, you know, we just saw the world of two-wheel road racing go for $4.5 billion, right? And, you know, Dorna has been spending a lot of money, and they've been paying dividends, and there's been a lot going on there. And that always suggested that something was coming. And, you know, last fall when I was in Valencia, there was a lot of discussion about this. And Liberty comes up all the time because, obviously, the seed money from Liberty came from the growth of cable and TV in the United States in the 80s, the ESPN and not much music. What's the American one?
MTV.
Yeah. Thank you very much. So there's, you know, the focus on media is not just because you and I work in media. It's really what makes these things work. However, having said that, you know, trying to find companies that are going to take those sorts of risks and see the value in that really cuts it down. So other companies that own other sports, you know, could easily have participated, and they definitely did shop. But I think Liberty just saw it as a fit. And also, you know, Liberty is doing very well right now. And obviously a company that can afford to leverage that, you know, it's shocking that that number has a B in it. It's not a million, it's a billion.
Well, right? And to put it in perspective for people, when you say like, okay, yeah, to me, it doesn't matter if it's 1 billion, 2 billion, 10 billion. Like as soon as you start saying that, people just go, yeah, that's a ton of money. Mm-hmm. But to put it in relative sports business terms, I believe the original Rogers Sportsnet deal with the NHL was 5.2.
Yeah.
Right? So you're talking about having a property that is not in the exact same. We're talking about, what, a $700 million difference between these two things, but roughly, give or take, you know, a little accounting error here or there. But the idea of having that property, the NHL, that has that number of teams, that number of games, that amount of inventory, because that's always the conversation when you're talking about baseball rights, is, yeah, you want to be able to fill your television schedule with the Dodgers or, you know, with the Miami Marlins, then Bally Sports is going to have every single Marlins game for you throughout the year. Same thing here in Canada with Rogers. It's like, that fills their summer. They have programming. That's what it is. That's
content is king.
That is a huge asset to be able to have something that has that much. MotoGP doesn't have that raw totality of
however
number of times, but
compared
then,
to Liberty,
yes,
right, they have a lot more product, and their product is packaged in smaller bites.
Yes.
And that's an interesting thing that's come up about Formula One lately, is people who consider themselves fans, a lot of them don't watch the whole race. They watch the pre-show, they watch the start. You know, we make fun NASCAR, you go and watch at the end. In Formula One, frequently you don't, because the race is well established in terms of the results. So the content question is quite interesting, because we're talking about three classes plus the electric bikes, and then, you know, I'm a huge fan of World Superbike, but, you know, we'll throw them in at the bottom. All of those classes, right, because they run a full slate of classes in the street bike four-stroke world, which is essentially at the moment a European championship. But there's a lot of content that Liberty is looking at, which is a positive. And then what are they going to do with some kind of docuseries, or how many of those series will yield a docuseries?
Well, and that's where I think you're going to see the, I guess, the totality of the content is going to be through the storytelling, because this is a sport that is built for that type of storytelling and that type of documentary style, as much as Drive to Survive was, and maybe even beyond. The other thing I find interesting is the switch in format to going to the sprints as well. Like being able to have those in, think about how much money that actually added to that deal, because the amount of extra content that you're getting out of that Saturday sprint through MotoGP things. I think that's probably played a large role. They were looking down the road to see how can we get more out of this.
Well, and intriguingly, Formula One does not always have a sprint race. They started it. MotoGP went to full sprint racing.
Yep.
And, you know, when I'm at Valencia and it's Saturday and the people are showing up like they normally do on Sunday, you know, and it takes 5 hours to load the place and 3.5 hours to empty it, because that's an awful lot of people in one place at the same time. You know, it's not set up like a conventional sports stadium here. And that's important, right? Because conventional sports stadiums are completely equipped to move you in, sit you down, feed you, have you go to the washroom, do all the things you need to do. By no means are racetracks all the same in that area. And when we talk about expansion and growth and opportunity, that's the biggest thing. Race fans tend to think about what's a cool track, you know, and we saw particularly during COVID some tracks that hadn't had races lately staged some fantastic events. But now we're talking about like what could happen, where's the growth, what's the opportunity. United States get mentioned a lot because Liberty has done so much in F1, but motorcycle racing is problematic because street racing isn't going to work. So
That was where I wanted to go next with it, is Liberty being U.S., obviously the immediate thought is, okay, they do COTA. What else?
Well, for me, the obvious is you pick somewhere that already could work, and that's Indianapolis. And, you know, COTA has a good crowd, probably in the 70,000 range, but it doesn't. It's half of what Formula One gets at the same venue, and they have NASCAR there. They've had World Endurance. Like, you know, COTA's had a lot of the big events. Indianapolis had a pretty good Grand Prix. I don't think it yielded enough to make it really interesting for everybody in terms of profitability. But the nice thing is it's pretty easy to go there. Moto America raced there 4 years ago. So I think that's the first place to look. And it's partly because it's a place you can put people, right? Indianapolis is fantastic in terms of the spectator opportunity and experience there. And I worked at those events, so I can see that it makes sense to go back. But when you start talking about, you know, a place like Laguna Seca, it just doesn't have enough space for people.
Right.
Barber is a beautiful track. IndyCar goes there. But, you know, it's, think of big spectator events in terms of Canadian motorsport. Well, Île Notre-Dame, which is, you know, you can take the subway to watch Formula One in Montreal. The Honda Indy in Toronto is a big event. Canadian Superbike at Mosport in August is almost in the same neighborhood spectator-wise as the Indy. So, it's one thing when you talk 30 or 40,000 people, but when you start talking Formula One numbers over 100,000, there aren't very many places that can take that kind of crowd.
What do you think would be, outside of Indianapolis, one that is potentially on the fringes of having enough to be able to actually get it done? Like, because you say Laguna Seca, it's like, yeah, it's beautiful. It just can't do it. Is there one that jumps out to you front of mind that is, it's right on the edge of maybe, and because I'm used to covering things like the Grey Cup where it's like, well, you know, Tim Hortons Field has a 25,000 seat capacity, and it's like, well, yeah, but they'll just throw 10,000 extra stands in there to be able to make it work for a Grey Cup, and then they fill the damn thing up.
Yeah, and we've had big expansion with the major soccer and football stadium in Toronto, and yep. We have the World Cup coming, so we've been hearing a lot about that if you live in Toronto. My question is, where's the venue that currently hosts medium-sized events that would be prepared to take the hit? And you got to remember, it can't be too rural, right? Like, it's great to say, let's go to Elkhart Lake. And way back when, MotoGP got so close to going to Elkhart Lake, but eventually it's just too far from Chicago, right? It's just going to be too hard to load enough people in there.
Everything's too far from Chicago. That's the problem.
So I don't... Anything could be on the table if the place is willing to spend the money to make the changes. You know, way back when it was millions of dollars at Laguna Seca to bring the track up to spec. And currently nobody's doing international races at Laguna Seca. And, you know, Moto America hosts a very, very strong event there. And we're talking about MotoGP and expansion partly because of the fact Liberty's American, partly because they've been expanding so aggressively in F1. But World Superbike right now is basically a European series.
Yes.
They have one flyaway, which is Australia, but they should absolutely have a race in Japan. They have manufacturers there. They should have a race in the States. It's the home of superbike racing, right? So that's another interesting question. You know, there's lots of properties that could use the attention. We talk about combined events that Liberty perhaps would have an F1 and a MotoGP. Interesting that so far there's never been a World Superbike and a MotoGP at the same time. And when Dorna bought Superbike, this was a huge topic of discussion. And the particular reason I bring this up is there's so much chatter on media about what do you think about this and what are they going to do about that. And there's ideas that people are coming up with that are really terrific and interesting, highly unlikely, and honestly, maybe the people involved who actually have the authority haven't considered these ideas. And I can just imagine, you know, a drinking game with the Dorna staff, right? Who thought of, you know, let's go to Barber, have a shot, right? So, of course, you know, they're the same as the rest of us. Everybody's like, who's got an idea? Who's got a out of the box, doodled off the page? What's the thing that we can do? But the biggest problem is in car racing, what the thing is we can do is build a track somewhere, you know? And they went to Vegas 40 years ago, and that was a mess. They went to Vegas last year. That worked better. But it's a lot harder with motorcycle racing. And of course, there's not an endless number of opportunities. And you need a dance partner, right? You need a promoter who thinks they know how to do it.
I'm extremely interested in the idea of stacking. Like you said, whether it's World Superbike with MotoGP, potentially Moto America, when MotoGP comes over, being the undercard and getting to race in front of those 80,000 people that you talk about. But the other interesting aspect of this, if you take it the other direction, is if you don't stack it, now that there is synergy between so many different levels, World Superbike, Formula One, and MotoGP, you could have the potential in your racing calendar to basically just spread out your property so that it is a consistent, it's available here, and then next weekend, and then the next weekend, and then the next weekend, and then the next, and then just, you could line up the calendar potentially depending on what happens with the tracks, but it's also about negotiating, I guess, with some of those tracks of saying, if you want blank, to come here, you're going to have to also take blank.
Well, something the average person doesn't think about is satellite time, right? There's only so much opportunity to broadcast, and the demands are huge. And lately, we've seen series tripping over each other in terms of their time slot, which isn't great. And for a while, MotoGP and Formula One were very careful not to overlap. Now they do a fair bit. And at one point, World Superbike was almost always on when F1 was on, right, because they were staying away from MotoGP. And lately, it's been a hot mess sometimes all with over. All the classes on, you know, sometimes literally at the same time that you have to make sure you have a facility to record because you can't watch them all at the same time. Now, I'm a bike guy, so I'm going to watch a bike race before I watch part of a Formula One race. It's also interesting talking about bike and car people, because a lot of my friends aren't that interested in F1, and you know, now I can say, see, I told you, it's important to pay attention to this stuff. But the flip side is that a lot of car people aren't that interested in bikes, and you know, we are totally interested and obsessed with Liberty and F1 and what they've been up to and what they could do and what they might do for us or against us. But a lot of car people just don't really care that much about motorcycle racing. The idea that there's the same crossover enthusiasm is just not the case. Now, I think Liberty see it, but they, you know, if you're looking around at other parallel businesses, if stick and ball people are going to look at other stick and balls, well, I'm sure Liberty and Dorna, I know Dorna spent a lot of time looking at how F1 does things. And you look at Dorna's ladder system, you know, we can start at the bottom with things like Tony Sharpless with her mini GP in Canada, and she's just linked into that system, and the Talent Cups in Europe and all the feeder classes. Dorna has done a fantastic job of streamlining. This leads us back to the States, because what we haven't been able to do is load very many Americans into the premier class. And they, you know, American or two racing in the top categories in MotoGP or the feeder classes would be fantastic. But in the end, it takes a lot of money and it takes a lot of talent. Chris Ulrich in Road Racing World wrote an editorial where he literally worked through the list of the people and how they got there and how much it cost. And it was it set you back in your seat to recognize how tough it is to get to the very highest level.
I'm not trying to poke a hole in your argument in any way, but I am wondering if Logan Sargeant is the proof positive of, yeah, you can throw an American in an Indy seat. Does it matter? Like, because that's always the conversation for these people that are trying to maximize these markets is, we'll do three races, Miami, COTA, Las Vegas, we'll have an American in the seat. Yeah, we're going to sell $1 billion worth of merch.
Yeah, I don't know if it works. I mean, it's tough because it's hard for me not to look at motorcycle racing as a competitor, just because a million years ago I was. And when you're looking at the very minor time spread across all the top qualifiers in the premier class MotoGP, you know, the Logan Sargeant model looks pretty scary there, because yes, you know, you don't want to be the guy who's 2 seconds back, right? In Formula One, it's much closer than it was, but 2 seconds isn't a ridiculous amount of time. In MotoGP, it's, you know, Petrucci was joking when he left that paddock, like, I was, you know, 2/10 of a second would be all the difference between the best weekend and the worst weekend. And I'm talking to Valentino Rossi, and he's in the same boat, and he's the greatest of all time, right? Like, the pressure at of the product at this moment, you know, how competitive MotoGP is. And no offense to Max Verstappen, but, you know, I watched qualifying from Suzuka this morning, and he looked pretty comfortable.
Looked like Max.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the most difficult and exciting tracks there is in the world. And, you know, MotoGP is not as predictable, and I mean that as a compliment to MotoGP.
Yes, yeah. And that's, I guess, where we'll go next before we wrap things up here from the robotics event. It looks like everybody finished their lawn chairs. We're hanging out inside the conference room. But the MotoGP year so far has been fun and chaotic. And I, for one, would just like to thank Pedro Acosta for making everything chaotic. Because it's so much fun watching a guy come in and just have absolutely no, it's not lack of respect, it's lack of understanding that he's not supposed to be doing what he's doing. And it's so, in any sport, I don't care, the person who comes in from a lower rank and has absolutely no clue what they're doing, not technically, you know, obviously he knows what he's doing, he's getting used to the bike and all the rest, but he just doesn't care what the expectation is supposed to be. And that's one of my favorite things in all of sports. But what have you enjoyed? I guess I'll ask you this. What's your favorite pass so far through the start of the year? Is it Top Rack in a sprint going underneath at the end of Catalonia? Is it Alex Lowe's on the outside at Phillip Island in World Superbike?
Everything Raz Gazlioglu does is so fantastic, and you know, good for BMW for hiring him, and thank you, because you know, more of him is never a bad thing. You know, my favorite pass of the year, and this is a cynical comment, is, you know, Pecco and Marquez because it didn't work. But they got at it a little earlier than we expected, and that's now established an interesting situation. I mean, it's so early in all the championships. I hate to get into that. What does this mean? Because the guys don't know yet, and there's so many races to come. World Superbike has three a weekend. A MotoGP has two. There's so much more racing that's going to happen. But I like how quickly it's ramped up and how much we seem to be into the season already, and I think that is super exciting. I didn't expect maybe what was going to happen with our new Gas star. I mean, certainly late in the season last year, and his test at Valencia pointed in a great direction. But I think we have such a high expectation of the stars riding so aggressively, give or take Bagnaia, who seems to me, I know some people don't think he's that good. I think he's just that smooth. But it's more fun to watch the people that aren't. And that's definitely the situation we're in right now. And that he has, you know, like think about what it's like for the guy directing that show, right?
Yes.
I'm not following the leader. Like no one is saying, how come we missed Dodd? No, go with that guy, right?
Well, the great thing about the directing of some of these MotoGP races early on this year, whether it be in Qatar and then the second round that they had in Portimao, was you can be, whatever, you know, but Jorge Martin's way up at running away out in front, or maybe it's Bagnaia back in Qatar, and you're not following it because, oh my God, Pedro's going crazy. He's just diving in on people all over the place. And now we got this conflict between Pecco and Marc Marquez. And then the thing that the ultimate wrench that got thrown into me was, oh, look, there goes Maverick Vinales sticking his leg out and then having no control going into turn one at Portimao, which must be terrifying.
Well, apparently that was a transmission issue. So, man, there's nothing scarier for a racer than a transmission problem. And I'm not necessarily that big a fan of Vinales, but I certainly don't want him on his head because the gearbox selected a gear for him out of neutral. But you look at Acosta and a couple of the moves he's made from a distance behind, and those are top rack moves, right? Those are the same one. Like the pass for the Saturday win at the last World Superbike race, he came from clearly behind on the brakes, made the apex, held his line. You know, it's if you're a club racer guy, like you can't dream of making a pass like that stick. You know you'd clobber the guy, which is kind of what's been going on for most of the rest of them. So, you know, that you get to watch, you know, those two different people do those kinds of moves. I mean, you need to take a step back. I've watched a lot of racing. I haven't seen very much that's any better than that. And knowing that, you know, next weekend we're going to see those guys roll up their sleeves and do it again. And, you know, for me, looking forward to the next big race, which is Circuit of the Americas, and that's been Marc Marquez's stomping ground. I was there the year he started, not on purpose, from the back because he had an electronics problem. And, you know, Ducati made such a big deal about how there's a new sheriff in town. Well, I can tell you all the people who were at that track, the old sheriff was still the sheriff.
Yeah.
There was no question he charged through the pack. And there again, there's a superstar doing what you know, not just you heard it or you read about it or you watched it on TV. You were there and Marc Marquez rode that way. And you remember those races when you get to see that in person.
And you're going down as well.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
You're going to be there in person. You're going to get some warm weather squeezed in before it actually starts to get consistently nice up here for us. But I will tie it back into one more CSBK thing before we start to wrap, which is you talk about Toprak and what BMW is doing with him and like the question of, wow, can they actually do this? What do you think Ben Young, our two-time defending champion, three-time champion overall, is thinking about when he's watching Toprak do that on a BMW on a World Superbike stage?
Well, I think Ben's excited. Obviously, he rides for the same manufacturer, but he also knows that when you're running a program like that, and you know the resources they put into the team are much increased, the resources to hire Toprak much increased, it has some effect on what's going on with other programs. And you know, now the rumor, which is I think more than a rumor, that BMW may join the MotoGP paddock. I think that's worrisome for everybody who's running a national program because, you know, we're advertising to the same people, right? We're watching different races, whether we're watching CSBK or World Superbike or MotoGP. It's a lot of the same fans, right? So it's worrisome. You know, do you want to be with an affiliated sponsor? Would you prefer to be with a, you know, Gas wasn't a factor 3 years ago. Now I'm sure people are trying to figure out what a Gas is because of one guy, right? And let me help you. It's a KTM. but you know, those are great stories to have. And I for one expect BMW to join in. And I think because of Liberty and the way TV works and, you know, understanding packages and deals with relationships with networks in various countries, I think it's going to be fun because, in case you missed it, the major player in the world of motorsport is now clearly Audi. They've recently bought a Formula One team, and they are owners of Ducati, who are the dominant player in both MotoGP and World Superbike. So Audi now casts an incredible shadow. And the reason I jump back to Audi is, you know, BMW, definitely pay attention to what's going on with Audi.
Yes.
And those are companies that are inclined to compete. On the motorcycle side, BMW probably pays more attention to KTM and Triumph because those are the boutique brands. But car side, and, you know, no offense to the motorcycle fans, but BMW sell a lot of cars too, so it's worth considering that. And you know, Formula One has new rules pretty soon. MotoGP has new rules fairly soon, and that's when new sponsors tend to arrive and manufacturers make changes. So it's an exciting time, and I'm sure from Liberty just trying to understand what it is they've bought. And of course, some of the management's going to persist, and a lot of the structures will be there for a while, but things will change, and, you know, electric bikes and electric cars, and there's going to be all kinds of new things.
You know what's terrifying to me is when you say MotoGP has new regs coming in relatively soon. It's 27, correct? And I want to say, oh my, that feels like it's so far away. And all that. I remember when Vince Carter signed a contract that ran until 2020 to be a Raptor, and I was like, that year's never going to come. That was like a 12-year contract or something ridiculous that he signed, but it will happen before we know it. And we'll be back at the track as well at Shannonville coming up round one. We'll have season previews and all that good stuff for you. I'm actually, you know what I'm going to do right now? This is the peak of the Bridgestone Canadian Superbike Championship as we head into the final lap. The white flag comes out.
One lap to go.
The white flag flies.
It's our last lap flag.
It's the white flag, the final lap.
Last lap flag, one to go.
I'm going to pick your white flag one final thought. Tell everybody what happened with the branding of Josh Herron's motorcycle, if you can. I'm just going to set you up for this because I think you are going to break international news here. That hopefully we're looking to grow this podcast, and I would love for us to get aggregated sitting in a robotics Mississauga International Center conference room with news that you understand how it was that OnlyFans mysteriously disappeared from Josh Herron's bike, and nobody had any damn clue why or how.
Well, it's the old credible source, right? So OnlyFans were announced as a sponsor for the Warhorse effort with the factory Ducati Superbike with a paint job that was OnlyFans. And then some of us wondered, well, when those bikes, not the same bikes, but similar Ducatis, Panigales, but twins, go to race at Daytona, will they look the same? And the answer was they were supposed to, but in the end, the OnlyFans logos came off. Now, Josh Herron's been involved with OnlyFans for a while. This is not a new thing, and the adult content element is not what he's been playing up. He's been doing motorcycle instructional stuff, and they make it clear about that.
Workout videos and celebrations from Daytona 200 wins. And
he's had OnlyFans on his helmet, and if you look at pictures, he holds up the helmet sideways on the podium with the trophy at Daytona, making it clear. So the story is that this came via the relationship that the Rahal team has, because they're Ducati.
Yeah, Rahal Ducati Moto, which was their debut at Daytona 200 with Kaley Yakov and PJ Jacobson and Corey Alexander.
Yeah, super team. Yeah. And reasonable, not great, but good results. And I thought they flew the flag. There's a lot of discussion about whether they really did well or not. I thought it was not bad. I thought it was a good start. But the story is that one of the investors in that team, who was very much involved with Audi, felt that sponsor was inappropriate, and the word got passed. Now, a lot of players in this, you know, Daytona Motor Speedway, the management of the Moto America series, and, you know, there are people, you know, crying that, you know, that OnlyFans are trying to spread their umbrella wider and, you know, change the appearance of their business. I can't speak to that. I don't know. I know that Herron has been a loyalist and has mostly, I think, said and done the right things and held to the higher ground. I'm suspicious that OnlyFans are certainly done in terms of the program that was announced to sponsor that team. And a little bit, and this is the thing I shouldn't say, but I hope other people are connecting the dots, that we are talking about two Ducati teams. And would Rahal maybe like to be the favored team with the most factory support? And is that kind of the way of Ducati, that they like to see everybody compete? Have you notice the 8 motorcycles in MotoGP on the grid. So internal competition is not necessarily something that Ducati discourage. And we did talk about Audi and F1, and there's a lot of influence and a lot of significant support and sponsorship and planning and marketing that isn't just for this year. Everybody looking down the road and what's going on. And let's mention also that Valentino Rossi currently drives a BMW in endurance racing. What do we make of that?
There's a lot of connecting of the dots and all of that. The one that I guess I would round it out with is Trevor Dion and his difficult Daytona 200, but being on the Ducati. And then, like you say, the internal tension that exists within potentially between the Warhorse team and the Rahal team in Moto America. We will see that play out. I believe they're Road America. Road Atlanta?
Road Atlanta is the opening round of Moto America. So that's when we'll see the superbikes for the first time this year. And, regular service is resumed. Everything's for points. And we start playing, half of the front runners, more than half of the front runners from Supersport at Daytona will not be running Supersport the rest of the season. So we'll see what that class actually looks like without the visiting dignitaries.
It's amazing. Everybody's just like, going to Daytona. Everybody's in. Okay. Go to a normal points round. We'll just show up and see where everybody starts racing. What do you guys want to do? What's your program going to be? It's incredible to see it come together. But this was a fun one. Thanks to everybody who's in this room for being our live studio audience. This is a live remote that we have done. And
I don't think they're too impressed with our robot knowledge, unfortunately.
We were walking in here with our podcast equipment, and you said, well, I don't think they're going to look at you strangely because you're carrying technology in your hands. That's probably a good way to round that out. But thanks for listening, everybody. We appreciate it. We will be back with a season preview unless we get bored. And show up at a different motorcycle show and then sit down at a robotics conference and have a conversation. Thank you, Colin.